Hi, it's Lucy and welcome back to The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I interview women working in the film industry. In this episode, I'm very excited to say I'm joined by a very special guest, Iranian-American director and writer Desiree Akhavan. Desiree has made waves with her bold storytelling and unique perspective on identity, relationships and the queer experience. You may know her from her award-winning film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, or the critically acclaimed Channel 4 series, The Bisexual. In this episode, Desiree talks about how her love for playwriting evolved into her future career, how music has inspired her latest project, her upcoming memoir, You're Embarrassing Yourself, and so much more. I hope you love this conversation and thank you so much for listening. There were a few sound issues, so I do apologise in advance, and there's also some swearing, so sorry, ma'am.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Desiree. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being so flexible.
Oh, it's
I'm
okay.
I'm so sorry that my schedule's been insane. I'm in prep at the moment, and things keep moving around.
It's okay. Schedule's always changing around as well, so don't worry about it.
You're doing work.
I work in a museum currently in France, like a contemporary art museum. It sounds quite cool. Like for me, it's just like my job, do you know what I mean? But it's in an old castle, a chateau. So yeah, that's quite interesting. But yeah, just talking to people all day about the art.
Where in France are you?
The town's called Rochessoire. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
Well, I'm familiar with the famous film with the girls. Wait, no, is it? I thought you said Rochefort. Like,
oh, no, not Rochefort. Rochechouart, but it does sound similar. I agree.
I heard what I wanted to hear.
But yeah, it's this really small town. The nearest place is like Limoges or Poitiers or Angoulême, if that rings a bell. Wes Anderson filmed The French Dispatch in Angoulême, which is not far from me. So that was quite a moment for like people around here. They're like, oh my God, a big American director is nearby filming. Thank you so much anyway for agreeing to be on my podcast and everything. I really appreciate it. And it's funny seeing you for real. I'm like, oh, you're a real person. Like, cause I've been watching like your films all week and videos about you and everything. So it's funny to actually see you for real.
Yeah, I always wonder what that's like for people. Because then you get like this crafted version of what I was like at 28 and then at like 32. And now I'm like, I always wonder how what it's like to meet someone who's already like given you a scrapbook of their past.
Yeah, I think it's also just like a little bit like being starstruck. Like, I guess if you're brought up on like TV and film and then you see someone that you've like, yeah, seen on film and TV, you're like, wow, they're actually a real person. But anyway, I don't know why you kind of forget it for a second. So you said you're currently based in Toronto. You're working on a secret project?
No, not at all. It's a new TV show for Amazon, produced by A24, written and starring this amazing comedian named Benny Skinner. And I'm directing half the episodes of this show. It's called Overcompensating. And it's about this kind of like this kid who's at college and he's, you know, like a real macho. He's rushing a frat, but he's secretly gay and hiding it from everyone. So.
That sounds really interesting. So kind of like,
yeah,
exclusive little preview there, or maybe not quite exclusive. I'm sure people know about it already, but I didn't. So that's exciting to know. So I'd love to get started in just asking you about the sort of beginning of your career. I mean, you say, yeah, you're now in your later 30s. So it probably feels like a bit of a while ago since you started out, but I know you're still very young. But I want to know what some of the early influences for you were in the beginning of your career and what kind of steered you towards filmmaking. And like, why was it this art form and not another one that you decided to choose?
Well, I really wanted to be a playwright as a kid. I grew up in the New York area, so like right outside of the city. And I went to high school in the Bronx, and everyone there was, well, I'll say that my best friend as a kid, her father was a playwright, and I was really inspired by that. But I started writing plays before I met her. I started writing plays around 9, and I think it's because I watched so much television at home. My parents are both immigrants from Iran, and we kind of grew up in front of a television set, and so we watched a lot of TV, and I really loved, like, Tracy Takes On. Tracy Ullman was a really big influence
Tracy.
On me.
I'm going to say something, I'm like, oh god, I don't know who that is.
Oh, Tracy Takes On was an American show, so it makes sense that you might not know. And yeah, she did these shows where she'd do different characters with different voices and different ethnicities, and it would be totally canceled and inappropriate today. But at the time, it was hilarious. It made sense. And, you know, she built these characters, and I loved that. I wrote, my first play was like a variety show that I called Friday Night Live. I wrote it had like a sketch, a fake advert for a product called Vomlet, the omelet made of vomit. It was how I got other people to hang out with me. I was like, well, I can't play your game, maybe, but because they would play like Clueless as a recess game, and mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to play, but I was like, well, I'm writing a play, and if you want to roll in the play, you're going to have to hang out with me. So that's sort of where it started. It was like really wanting to connect to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote plays, and then I started taking it seriously in high school when I made this, my best friend, whose name is Hallie Pfeiffer, and she's actually the showrunner on the latest series of American Horror Story now.
Wow.
And
I'm
very
okay.
proud of her.
So you've both gone on to great things.
Yeah, she's a really gifted playwright, and I worshipped her. And we both wrote plays in high school and started this one-act play festival there. And when I got to college, I just didn't fit into the theater scene there.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a lot of Carol Churchill, Little Brecht, like, just wasn't my vibe. I like Chekhov, and in like contemporary-wise, I like Chris Durang. I like things that felt, you know, the opposite of Brechtian. I'll say that much.
Okay. So can you tell me about the rest of your early studies and your first sort of steps of work experience into the industry after that?
In university, I really stepped away from theater. I didn't get into any of the plays. So I took a bunch of random classes, and one of them was a film introduction to film class, and I really fell in love. And from then on, it felt really clear that I had to become a filmmaker. After university, I spent a year applying to film school and just doing every job I could on set. I was the world's worst script supervisor. I remember, I used to go on this website, I don't know if it still exists, it's Mandy.com.
Mandy. And, I think I've heard of Mandy, yeah.
Yeah, it was sort of like the lesser impressive American counterpart to ShootingPeople.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great website, but I think we had like a jankier version. And I would just apply for everything, even though I had no experience. I have a very bad memory, so it was horrible that I went onto anyone's set and did script supervision, and I would get so distracted. I remember at one point, the producer came up to me and he was like, "We're filming, shouldn't you be in there?" And I was like, "I think so." You know, I read the one book there was on script supervision. I did a, you know, sound recording, boom operating, and then I like settled into ADing. I really liked ADing, but when I started grad school, that was more time to do all of these jobs. I think that I pretty quickly went into graduate school for filmmaking at NYU.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have a lot of time. I couldn't trust myself like out in the world. I think I needed structure and like a safe, quote unquote safe, I don't know how safe it was. No regret, I don't know how safe it was. Place to fail. And I did a lot of failing at film school. And during that period, I worked on endless short films. I think the meat of that time was supporting your classmates and just living on set nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't in the classroom.
So was that, did that come as like quite a surprise to your family that you were like, I want to go into film, or did they all see that as something that you would be good at?
No one was surprised. I was my dad always said, he was like, if you were doing this, I don't know what you would be doing. I was a bad student and I tried very hard. I have a learning disability, and I have tutors, and I was up all night studying, and I tried so hard, and I had a really difficult time doing well in school.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take to it well, and I took to this. It was something that always felt natural,
mm-hmm.
writing, storytelling, creating characters.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a surprise. It was unstable, and I think we were all worried, for me, of what kind of future was I going to have, especially since I wasn't the type who would just, like, marry into money. I think the daughter of Iranians, you have, like, one of two options. And do well professionally, or, like, own your own business, become a doctor,
uh-huh.
or marry well. And neither of those options seemed like they fit. So
uh-huh.
I think everybody, myself included, we were all nervous. But there was also this deep knowledge that this was right.
And I think also the fact you threw yourself into all those jobs, you know, after, you know, applying for them online, even though you weren't really sure if you're capable, that just goes to show that you were sort of brave enough, I think. And
shameless. It was unfair to the people that I worked with. However, I'll also say that I graduated college in 2007, which was right before the subprime mortgage crisis, or just as it was hitting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the job market was terrible. I applied for jobs everywhere in marketing, in publicity, in as a temp, in any office I could,
mm-hmm.
as a waitress, as a hostess, as a nanny.
Mm-hmm.
I applied for jobs in all arenas,
mm-hmm.
and then ended up doing a lot of free work on sets.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked as a a receptionist. It was so funny. The only job I got was as a receptionist at a post-production commercial house. And yet I was only offered, like, there was a month or two. It was like, yeah, 2 months before one of the client's daughters was getting the job. That was like, it was so funny to me. I was like, my job is answering phones and ordering people's lunch. And yet this job is going to a girl whose father owns like Coca-Cola. Like, it was like his nature. He wasn't Coca-Cola. He just was like, he was one of their biggest clients at this production house. And one of their biggest clients was like, my daughter needs a job, and they were going to hire her, but she first was going to go ski in Aspen for the holidays. So they needed someone to fill the gap. And that was the only job I could get. It was like temporary receptionist. And it felt really bleak. Like there was no marketplace for any professions. It also felt like, why the fuck not go into film, into something that looks so unstable? No one else's job is stable. I can't even be a receptionist.
Yeah, I've had that thought too. I've thought, you know, why not go into something you genuinely want to do when all the other markets of jobs seems to be quite unstable anyway? So you might as well do something that you genuinely want to do. So you mentioned there about your parents and your heritage and everything. I was wondering how your Iranian-American heritage has influenced your storytelling, both in like the themes you explore and the characters that you create as well in your films and your TV shows.
It's a huge influence. I think that I haven't explored it as much as I think I was so focused on being, I guess, like shedding shame around my sexuality that a lot of my work was more focused on romance. And now at the next stage of my life, like after we shot The Bisexual, my writing partner and I began to focus on Iran and started writing a film about that takes place during the Islamic Revolution. And I think that shift happened because we were both ready. We were like, okay, we've said some things we wanted to say about dating. It would be nice to shift to this new subject matter. So to be honest, I think it's who I am, and my who you are is intrinsically woven into everything you make, no matter who you are. But I will say now, moving forward, the next phase of my filmmaking career is much more focused on that.
I was wondering about how you approach developing a new project, talking about appropriate behavior and the miseducation of Cameron Post. With both of those films, did you start with a theme? Of course, with The Miseducation of Cameron Post, you started with having read the book, but with your other projects, do you start with a theme or a character, or is it more of an idea that comes to you first? What's the kind of starting point when you're making a film?
Could you give me 1 second? I just got
no worries.
A sensitive question from set, and I just want to respond to it. You are doing a prosthetic test right now.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, before I got on this call, I silenced my phone, but first I was like, I love it, I approve. And now I just saw an urgent text, and it was like, they want to know if they could send the prosthetic guy home. And I was like, oh yeah, I said I liked it, it's your call. All right, he loves this, he just wants to double check with you that the correct arm, you want the prosthetic.
A few moments later.
Okay, I've said what I needed to say, but I'm just going to keep my phone on.
That's okay.
You were asking me about how I originate a story and like where it all begins. Okay, for each project, I think the origin point shifts. It's not always been the same, but of course it's like a spark of inspiration, and it's kind of like falling in love. Like, you can't get something out of your head. It kind of gets into your bones, and you start seeing the world through that lens. With Cameron Post, I had shared the book with Cecilia after we shot Appropriate Behavior, saying, you know, one day this would be a cool project, but I didn't think we'd do it next. And it was Cecilia, my writing and producing partner, who was like, no, this is what we're doing. And she had so much drive and belief with it that it was very easy to then follow her enthusiasm. Because I had it too. I mean, I read it and I immediately wanted to make it a movie. But I read it years earlier. I read it before I made Cameron Post. I read it while I was making it. Before I made the film. Before I made a behavior. I read it while I was making a web series called The Slope. Was sort of the first thing I made that I put on for public consumption online, and it still lives online. So Cheshire loved that, and then we began this really long process of like first writing a very faithful adaptation, and then figuring out that the journey to telling that story was completely throwing away what was, you know, the structure of the book and inventing our own and holding true to those characters that we loved so much. With the next film, it started with music. So like each one has a different entry point.
I was actually going to ask about music, so it's interesting that you bring that up.
I had never entered a story through music. I love music, and I listen to music while I'm writing often. I mean, sometimes I can and sometimes I can't, sometimes it's really distracting, but usually while I'm putting something, writing something, I'll put together a playlist, you know? Like, I like music, and I love the way it transforms. God, I'm so embarrassed by that quote. I need to start over again. I like music. I will say, so what I found in the creative process is music usually comes in post, and it informs the story so well in post, and especially when I'm working with my editor, Sarah Shaw, who's a musician and has a really encyclopedic knowledge of music, mm-hmm. world music. But with this project that we're working on now, it began with a song. There's an album that I really love of pre-revolutionary Iranian music called Back to the Brink by an artist named Kurosh Yamoyi. And I'd always loved it. One of the songs, Guliyah, went into Perfect Behavior for a montage. Another song, Layla, went into The Bisexual. It's Iranian, but also feels Western and a bit funkadelic. It's called Pre-Revolutionary Iranian Funk, I think is what it says. Mm. But it has like a Western sensibility and sex appeal. Mm-hmm. And I really love this album. And there's a song on it called Varuna. And when I heard it, I could always see a scene. And the scene that played out in my head was my parents at the airport trying to leave Iran at the height of the unrest before, I would say like around the time after the Shah left Iran, as Khomeini was coming into power. I always heard stories of them like hiding pearls and diamonds in my brother's diapers and waiting in the airport to leave for hours and it being like ransacked by people. They stayed there for over 24 hours with a 40-year-old baby and just weaving lines that snaked through the entire airport. And every time I heard this song, I could see them in there. But it also felt a little bit like American Hustle. It felt like nervous energy, exciting. Are they going to get away with it or not? Are they going to escape? Who knows? And I heard this music and I always saw this scene and I wanted to chase that. And it, to be honest, it's the hardest entry point I've ever had for a project. Mm-hmm. It sounds so when I say it out loud right now, mm-hmm. but it was so difficult then to figure out, okay, well then like you're inspired by your parents, you're inspired by the revolution, you're inspired by the story of those who stay and those who go, where you could do anything. Like from that song, from that scene, any story could be told. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the years that we've been writing, and usually we write as we come to a final screenplay in like a 12 months. That's what Tachi and I had done for our previous projects. It took us about, I would say, 12 months. I'm in my sixth year of this project. We began in 2019.
But then there was COVID in between, I suppose.
I mean, we worked during COVID. Yeah. Like we've had, I don't know, I feel like maybe 6 or 7 page one rewrites and complete overhauls and revisionings of this project. And we finally figured it out. I think maybe when we finally figured out this structure is about 2 years ago, and now it's pretty much done, and I'm very, very happy with where it's landed. But this journey has been a long one of false starts and trying again and again to figure out what the narrative arc is to match the emotional triggers of that song, of that picture in my head. So I this is a very long-winded answer to your question. Like, what's your inspiration? And I was like, basically this one was a wrong. This inspiration was so flaky and it was so hard to like actually pin down, but it still remains true to this day. When I hear that song, I feel those feelings and I see our movie and I get excited. And maybe it was just the emotional like journey of these years personally that made it so hard. I don't know. I think writing and creating during COVID, I'll say for myself, was really difficult. I think when your ego takes, and even for me, it was before, I think after making The Bisexual, my ego took a really big blow. And I think it's hard to create when you're losing sense of what your voice is and who you are as a maker. And I had spent my 20s building that muscle and being like, this is who I am. And then something happened in my 30s where I think I just needed to outgrow that voice and find a new one.
Mm. Did you feel like you'd lost momentum or something?
No, I think I'd lost my connection to my own voice. Say, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. What is the point? And what is my North Star for all of this? Mm. It had to shift. It had to change. And I think as you change as a person, your work also shifts with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like, I guess, a bit of a filmmaker identity crisis in some way, would you say?
I don't know if I'd say identity crisis. I think, honestly, I can only just explain it as I lost my voice.
You lost your artistic voice, what you wanted to say.
No, not even. I'm so sorry. I don't.
I'm getting it all wrong.
I can't whittle it down to artistic. Okay. I lost track of my own sensibility and confidence in my own point of view choices. Like, mm-hmm. all you have as a director is your taste and your belief in that taste. And I think I lost a big sense of what that was. And maybe we're saying the same thing. I think I'm still looking for the language for it. It sounds mm-hmm. so flaky. But like, the core of a director is this vision that you hold inside you and you communicate to your team.
Mm-hmm.
And all of you then follow that as like this guiding light. And I think I lost track of what that guiding light was and mm-hmm. why I was doing it. It was like, there was so much content. We were just kept making more content or wanting to make more content or meeting about content. The idea of content, especially like the more you monetize film and television, and the idea of content as this like glut product being shelved to the masses, mm-hmm. I think it can fuck with your sense of the work itself. Like, the business of making movies, I think, began to trump the art of making movies. It became hard to figure out what we were doing, because there's a commercial version of this, there's an art house version of this, there's a fucking Noah Baumbach version of this, there's a, you know, there are 1,000 versions of the same thing. What's my version of it? I lost track, because I was trying to please a lot of other people.
Right, okay, because that's interesting. I was going to go on to that a little bit, because I recently watched your TED Talk about why you should disappoint your parents. So that was really interesting, and yeah, I just enjoyed your sort of, I don't know, yeah, TED Talk. I was going to call it a speech, but I guess it's sort of like a speech. Then how did you gradually sort of gain back that confidence to live a life and a career on your own terms, which possibly disappointed your parents a little bit, and also maybe, you know, went against industry norms? And do you feel like you've got that voice back that you said that you lost, or are you still trying to get it back?
Well, the disappointing my parents happened a long time ago. And I think a lot of appropriate behavior in my early work, The Slope as well, was about that. And letting go of shame and letting go of any expectations that they had for me and creating my own expectations. But then I got caught up in what those expectations were in terms of, like, I think the industry and how could I be as successful as possible according to like every news outlet I've ever interviewed with. And that became its own. I invited in a new set of parents, you know, Hollywood. And it messed with my perspective. And I do think I've worked through that. It's been a really great transformative time, especially the past few months. And I think I wish I had a nice soundbite for like how to get over it. I think you need to like sit in the muck for a while. I think sometimes you need to like grieve. And I think I had to grieve a lot of things, and I had to try and fail a lot. I feel like I've tried and failed a lot of different versions of different paths, and now you just surrender to what's in front of you.
Mm.
And like try to figure out what it is you want to do. I think it's like, okay, here's what maybe it is. I think it's strengthening your relationship to your own instincts and whatever that is. And right now that's, you know, I'm really enjoying making this show. I'm writing a rom-com, and I'm enjoying that process. I think it's about finding again. And then also I'm enjoying swimming. Also I'm enjoying like being out in the world. I'm enjoying like my life as a person and meeting people and like existing outside of work as well, which is a very new concept for me. Like living life instead of recording it so that I could put it on screen. That's new.
I'm going to go back a little bit to back in 2018 when you won the Grand Jury Prize in Sundance for the Best Education of Cameron Post. And that must have been such like a pivotal moment in your career, such like a life-changing moment. And I'm wondering how that recognition shaped your approach to storytelling and the kind of projects you were going to pursue after that. Did it kind of, because you were talking there about, you know, how, you know, Hollywood suddenly coming into your life and things changing, you know, it changed your perspective on things. Did getting that recognition sort of, yeah, it must have been like a relief, but also, you know, like what's next as well at the same time.
Yeah, I think winning Sundance, I'm so grateful. I'm still in shock that it happened. It was such a wonderful gift, and it really fucked me up. It's really good that it happened. I'm grateful. It didn't send me on a great path. I feel like I I got very distracted by the opportunities around me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to handle what was happening. Because as the moment, I wasn't even there when we won it, because I was in London shooting The Bisexual. Things were happening so quickly, and I didn't have time to digest any of it or imagine like what I wanted. I think I was listening too much to the voices around me, and I began to detach from my own voice at that stage. So this whole journey that I won't shut up about losing my voice, I think it began at that moment in time from that incredible gift. So it's kind of funny to be like, this amazing thing happened and I lost my fucking mind.
I mean, I think that's really both like really authentic and vulnerable for you to say, though, because I think a lot of people think that once that happens, then you are like, you're sorted. I think that's, you know, for a lot of people, they think once, whatever career you're in, it can be in the film industry or something else, like once I reach that goal, then I'm okay. But there's always like another goal afterwards. So it's like it kind of just keeps going.
And if you're not solid in yourself, if you're looking outwards to see who you are, and I feel like when I started out, I was kind of solid in who I was, mm-hmm. and that's what I wanted to put on the screen. And then over the course of being seen, I really lost track of that person, and I started listening so closely to what other people wanted from me, and I got really confused.
As you were saying just before, you're enjoying swimming and seeing the world and everything. I'm interested to know how you now maintain that balance between your personal life and your creative work, especially given the demands of the industry, you know, where you're on call quite a lot of the time. What kind of hobbies do you have outside of film and writing where you can sort of center yourself and just disconnect from it?
I'd like to be clear that I really haven't figured out a balance at all. And I'm living out of a bag. I've been living out of a bag since December. It is August.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. And it is not a lifestyle I would recommend. I don't like it. I'd like to settle down. I don't know where to settle down. I don't have a community. I have so many people I love. And I've decided to spend this year, you know, when I'm not on set or actively writing with my writing partner in person, visiting people I love around the world and like spending time with them. Everyone around me is, you know, having their second child and kind of set into their life. And since I'm not set in my life, I've decided to connect with those who are, and I'm having an amazing time, and I'm learning a lot. So right now, I'm sort of on this weird journey of, like, make things and connect. Find, like hold on to the people you love, and find something with each step of that journey. But I'm not there where I want to be. I'd love to build a life. I'd love to build consistency. I'd love to figure out what that balance is. And I feel good that it'll happen, but I think it'll be a journey.
And when you're working on set, since you're spending so much time on set and working in the career that you do, how do you ensure that it stays like an environment that feels healthy and fun and just more uplifting than stressful?
Well, it's very different if it's a television set I've been hired to direct on that I didn't write versus a film set that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like each project has a different hierarchy. So right now I'm on someone else's set, and it's my job to keep it running efficiently and to communicate the showrunner's vision and to keep it as positive. And I think it's a wonderful set. And I think a lot of this is a really lovely group of people, so it's quite easy. But a lot of your job as a director for hire is keeping things positive and pleasant and functional. And I mean, yeah, of course, on your own set as well, but there's much more control in tone and vibe when you're doing work that you created and are the driving force behind, as opposed to more of a hired hand. But I love that about set. I think it's created for positivity. I think it's created for functionality. You're a traveling circus every day, unless you're shooting on a soundstage, but even when you're on a soundstage, you're like putting a tent. You're building all these fantastical worlds and then shutting them down and you're doing it for long hours. And the way that the beast functions is through people's attitudes. And I think that the people who can't sustain that kind of positivity don't stay in the industry. The people I know, the artists I know that have been doing this for decades are people that understand that the love and the community and the kindness is, and the hard work is what sustains itself, what makes this job and this set sustain itself, and And I think that's why I'm so attracted to this work too, is I think it requires positivity and it requires hard work and a solution-oriented personality. And without those three ingredients, this might not be the job for you.
So, yeah, obviously I want to get on to talking about your book very soon, but just talk a little bit more about TV. And I'm wondering how you approach TV differently to filmmaking. Is there a specific process that you have when you're approaching film as opposed to TV? Because, of course, you've got to do it over a longer period of time, although I know a film is also over a long period of time to be done, but I mean that there's more episodes and more content.
It's just so different. It's everything about it is different. And when I had written The Bisexual, I had never been on a television set, and I, except for, you know, cameos I did as an actor, but I had no idea what I was getting into. And it really was a rude awakening. Television is a machine. It is much more corporate. You are working underneath the thumbs of networks. Even the most wonderful networks that you could collaborate with are still your bosses. You still have a boss in that sense. I mean, I've never made a studio film. I've made indie films. So I was really naive about what I was getting into. It's just a really different beast. And once you learn the rhythm of it, it can be quite lovely and make a lot of sense. But movies are indulgent. You know, movies are luxurious. They're not. I mean, they're like indie films especially. I would laugh at myself saying luxurious, but in terms of process, in terms of the time and space you can allow yourself, even when you're moving quickly, it's still, there can be some privacy that is really hard to have in television.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of, like, I don't want to say secrecy. I guess there's space for intimacy that I haven't felt on television.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that's like one of the best rewards of working outside of like the traditional sort of Hollywood system by doing independent films? And what 100%. What would you say are more of the challenges then by working outside of that?
I mean, there's no infrastructure for getting it into the world. Like, or there isn't very much. There is, but like, I would say, I don't think my films have touched as many people as the work for hire I do does. Like, Hacks will be seen by millions and millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that my movies will be, and that's okay. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
Hacks, a commercial enterprise. Like, it's something that reaches a wide audience, and it's a wonderful show, and I couldn't be more proud to have been a part of it.
You've also acted in your own films and TV. How does stepping behind the camera influence what you bring in front of it? Would you say it's the same, Desiree? I'm probably saying your name a bit French. Desiree.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Desiree. I like all pronunciations.
It sounds really nice. What is the origin of your first name, by the way? Like, what's the meaning behind it?
It's just a French name. I mean, my parents...
What is a French name, then?
Yeah, it's a French name. And my parents went to Paris after the Islamic Revolution and lived there for a few years. And I think they met someone with a baby named Desiree that they thought it was beautiful. And then they moved to New York City, and I was born there. And I think the name had lived with them from their France days.
Yeah. It's a lovely name, and I don't actually hear it that much in France. But yeah, so you've acted in your own films and TV, from Appropriate Behaviour to Girls as well, and The Bisexual. So yeah, how does stepping behind the camera influence what you bring in front of it? And do you feel like you almost like adopt a different, you put on a different hat completely, like you're going into, stepping into two different Desirees? Or...
Yeah, I think I write about this in my book, but I think that there are two different skills, and it's like trying to be both like mother and daughter at the same time, or parent and child at the same time. Like, to be a director is to have an eye on all things, to be constantly tracking the entire beast of production and be thinking about the, like, the moment before, the moment after, the moment coming next, the mise-en-scene, the everything. But to be an actor in a scene, it's to like whittle your focus down to a laser point to what is in the scene, what is being given to you at that moment, and what are your circumstances, and what are you reacting off of.
Mm-hmm.
There's such different skill sets, and there's such different objectives, and I think it's quite difficult, actually. I think it's better to not, I mean, it's, of course, it's good on a technical level to know more as an actor, but I do think it's very tricky to do both at the same time. It's something I probably will not do very often in my life moving forward after the experience of The Bisexual. Yeah, I think one can kind of hinder the other. I'm not an actor. I've done it, and I love it. It's so fun. It's so wonderful. and I hope opportunities come in my life moving forward where I'm able to do it here and there, but I am definitely a director in my heart of hearts.
Because I find that also as an actress, you're very fearless in terms of what you can do on screen and what you feel comfortable with. So where do you think that sort of fearlessness comes from, both in directing as well? Because I guess as a director, you also have to be pretty fearless as well.
Well, it's really easy to be fearless when you know that your hand is at the wheel, when you feel empowered in that way. I go there because I'm doing it to tell my own story. And I know that I'm the one who's going to be shaping that performance in post. And there's a trust there between me and me. And so it doesn't feel like a difficult order to be able to push myself into weird scenarios on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I'm at the helm of it.
Yeah, when you're in control. So yeah, I'd love to talk about your new book, which is coming out next week, called Your Embarrassing Yourself, Stories on Love, Lust and Movies. And first of all, I'd love to know what inspired you to write your first ever memoir.
The opportunity came to me after Appropriate Behavior came out, and I felt like I had all these funny stories of humiliation, and they didn't quite work in movies, so it felt like the right format, and I was ready to try something new. And yeah, it's a memoir, and it's also I think a comedic look at some of the more humiliating moments in my existence.
Because I can imagine that writing it, I mean, maybe not because you've already, written a lot of your personal experiences into some of your previous work anyway, but I can imagine writing a memoir must be a very vulnerable experience. Was there any moments that were difficult to write for you, and did you have to, sort of push yourself through to be able to write it onto paper, put pen to paper?
It was a lot harder. And I have to say, it's funny that it's become about humiliation. I think it's a story of how I became a woman and the long journey of womanhood from 19 to 39. And it was difficult because I think with film, you write something down, but that's just a blueprint. So many more people come in with their point of view and their talents, and they make it better and better until it builds this independent life that it takes on. With this, it was just me and the raw story and my memories of what had happened in my life. And that was far more vulnerable and difficult to face and move forward with than anything I've ever made.
Was there ever a moment when you felt like maybe you were sharing too much, or you were just like, you know what, I'm going to spill the, I'm just going to spill the tea, say it all? Or did you have to reel yourself in a bit?
I think it's hard to know where to draw a line, for sure. And I had to continuously ask myself, is this fair to other people? I think anything that ended up getting censored was stuff that I felt made other people vulnerable. And I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to keep myself in the hot seat. However, it didn't seem right to expose other people's secrets or lives, especially from my point of view. I know I can be an unreliable narrator. We all are unreliable narrators. We remember things as we remember them. That's code in whatever emotion you were feeling at that time, which colors it greatly. So yeah, it was a constant test of what's too far. But I think when it came to my own stories and my own vulnerabilities, I didn't feel like there was ever a point in holding back. I think if it was compelling, I think the question for me was always, is this compelling enough to share, or is this navel-gazy? And you know what? Everyone has a different opinion on that. Some people will be like, this is super navel-gazy, and other people will be like, I relate to this, I like it. It's really hard to measure, and you can only go by your own taste.
Mm-hmm.
So according to my taste, this is what was, a fine amount of exposure to share. But the truth is, these are universal feelings, and I don't feel shame about them. I don't feel shame about, the story of how I lost my virginity to a cokehead I met in a support group for cutters. It's a funny story. It happened. It was a very intense, foolish time in my life. And I think there's beauty in that kind of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Were there things that maybe felt embarrassing or shameful at the time, but now you look back in retrospect, you're sort of more filled with gratitude, or you kind of understand it in the whole picture, when you look at it as a big picture?
Yeah, when I look at it as a big picture, I think life is messy, and I tried some shit out, And it's funny. Like, I hate to think all of this, like, dying. I wouldn't dye my hair blonde again, but after a tough breakup, I did. And I write about how stupid I looked in the process of, you know, making such a bold choice and having to live with this, like, scarlet letter on your head. I do not suit white blonde hair.
I don't think I saw any photos online of you with blonde hair. Maybe you tried to avoid any pictures at
the
time.
No, they're not. I mean, I was not photographed during that period. It was a bleak, heartbroken moment in my life that lasted only 3 months. And in terms of the hair, like, after 3 months of trying every shade under the sun, it was right before I shot Cameron Post. And I was so desperate to look and feel different than how I felt, which was just completely heartbroken. And making that film really mended my heart in a lot of ways. But yeah, I went into it with the dumbest fuchsia hair because I was trying on all these different colors.
And trying to go back to your original color, maybe.
Well, I was trying to find the look. It was like, what is the look? And it's such a... That pursuit was in vain, basically. But I think at, like, the weaker moments of my life, I'm like, if I drastically change everything about how I look, maybe that'll solve these emotional...
I think that goes through a lot of our heads when we go through like a breakup or something. I think it's a very universal thing. How would you say that writing the memoir has changed how you see a connection between your life and your art now? Do you see that from, like, did you have some sort of revelations as well while you're writing it that did it reveal parts of yourself that you didn't realize were there?
I think it revealed to me how much support I have in loved ones. I think it's hard to see it. And hard to picture the wealth of love in your life until you put it down on page and you're like, oh, actually, my family was really there for me in a big way. And a lot of the stories feature my parents. And I don't know if it'll affect my work. I think that the script, the film I'm making next, is a little influenced by them. Like, it was sort of began as a testament to them and has transformed into something different, which is the journey I love for a project to take. The book was difficult because it didn't have that journey. But I think that was the link with the book. I think the book was became so much about the two of them and the sacrifices they made for me and my brother. And then this film really came from that, from like, I would love to honor my family.
Would you see your embarrassing yourself being adapted into a film, or
at this moment, no? But never say never.
Never say never. I mean, it sounds really interesting, and I can't wait to read it. Obviously, I haven't yet because it's not come out yet. But I can't wait to get.
It's now on the 15th of August.
Yes, that's
so
it.
It's happening
very soon. Yeah, I'll definitely get my copy. Why should people read your book? What would be one reason you should tell them to go and buy it and read it?
I would say if you want a good laugh. Let me think, hold on.
Yeah, take your time.
I think if you want to, like, read some embarrassing truths, like, cloaked in hilarity. I think if you like honest stories, cringe-inducing stories, comedic stories of growing up and becoming a woman, this is probably the right book for you, the right fit.
I think it sounds like the right book for me then. I mean, I love reading like stories about, yeah, like, I mean, I'm 20, 29. I almost like was like, what is my age? I can't remember. 29, so I'll be 30 next year. And like, it's definitely reassuring to read about women that have been through things like me, that have gone through all the pains of growing up and breaking up with people, friends, lovers, whatever. It's definitely reassuring to read about people that have made the same fuck ups as you, and it just makes you feel a bit more human and a bit more normal and realize that it's just part of the human experience to do all these things and experience all these things. I think I'm currently reading How to Be Famous by Caitlin Moran. It's a fictional story, but it's very much about, you know, a young girl that's just moved to London and she's doing all these like ridiculous things, but it's just so funny. And it's true, I mean, the mistakes we make do make for the funniest stories. So I was wondering what your advice would be to future female filmmakers like yourself who are just starting out in the industry.
I always have the same piece of advice, which is that you should not wait for anyone to give you an opportunity, that you should find a way to create your own opportunities, however small or insignificant they may feel to you. I feel like I watched a lot of people waiting for permission from various gatekeepers, from financiers or from professors or from, you know, funding bodies or grants and or even like labs. And if I had waited for someone to give me a thumbs up to do something, I would not have ever made anything. there's so much discouragement along the way, and if you listen and you take that as a sign to stop, I think you could cut yourself off from great work, and you might be waiting forever, which would be unfortunate. And it's true, sometimes it means you have to do things a lot cheaper and a lot dirtier, and you're not going to make them by your own standards, but you're going to make something. And I think there's so much to be said about just fucking making a thing, getting from it, and then moving on.
Yeah, no, not waiting around, giving yourself the permission. When people look back at your sort of body of work in the future, what do you hope they would say about the impact you've had on film and representation?
Want to think about that?
I can pick a different question.
No, it's okay. You can ask that question. I just want to say, like, that's none of my business.
Yeah.
And I think thinking too much about that is not a good space for me to be in terms of the work. Like, thinking about how people will view it in the future, or me, or what my impact should be. Like, I want to do my thing, and I really hope it has a positive impact, and I pray that it is moving something forward. And if it's not, it's not. And I can feel good that I was kind to the people I worked with. You know, like, I don't want to look at it in these grandiose terms of, like, how am I shaping the industry or whatever. I don't want to take that responsibility, and that responsibility exists in anyone who makes anything, for sure. I just don't, and I think some people can make work and think of it in that respect, or that, like, that framing, and be energized by it, but I find it really I find it really draining to look at it like that.
Mm-hmm. For you, compared to when you started out in the industry and up until this point, how have you seen things improve or change in terms of representation for women and also for the LGBTQ+ communities on screen? How has it changed for you from your perspective and from what you've seen? Because you've really got, like, a insider's, you know, view of what's going on, and how have you perceived it?
Oh, no, I'm not good at answering this question. I think that there is more representation on screen that we can all see, and there are more opportunities that we can all see, but I don't necessarily think the gatekeepers have shifted. The makeup of the gatekeepers has not necessarily shifted, and money talks and will always be the driving force of this work. And if people don't support the work that is made by marginalized communities, in this case, the LGBTQIA community, then, you know, it won't be made. But I will say, I'm not sure if 10 years ago, a show like the one I'm working on now, Overcompensating, which is, you know, created by a young gay comedian named Benny Skinner, who is telling this hilarious laugh-out-loud comedy story about this, you know, frat boy who's closeted. I don't think this would have been made 10 years ago. And it's being made with Amazon and A24 and an amazing cast. And
so things have changed.
I don't know. I mean, it's tricky. I can't say things. I really don't want to say things have changed, because I have so. I see, you know, there are huge issues, however, like, systemic, interwoven into this industry issues. However, I also think it's really special that this kind of content is being made right now.
So for just the last few questions, I'll make them. There's some just more light and fun ones, and nothing too, like, big. If you could work with any director or writer, living or dead, for a dream project, who would it be, and what kind of film would you make together?
I have to be honest with you, I wouldn't, because I think that writer-directors shouldn't collaborate in that way. Like, I think if there's a writer-director on board, then I shouldn't be there. Like, I'm a huge... I'm such a huge fan of so many people, and I'm not necessarily sure if we would collaborate well together. There would be so many amazing people. Sarah Polley, Miranda July is amazing, Anya's Varda, Catherine Braylat, like, so many people I worship, but I don't necessarily think that we should collaborate in that way. I can't imagine any gifted writer-directors who I think should, like, get into the ring together. I think, like, everyone's voice is so distinctive.
Good answer.
Its own space.
If you could write or direct a biopic about women in history that hasn't been given much attention, who would you choose? Maybe there isn't one.
I don't like biopics. I feel like I'm the worst at this game. I'm, like, making no.
Maybe I should just ask you, like, tea or coffee?
maybe Alice Walker.
Alice Walker?
The writer of The Color Purple.
Ah, okay. Yeah, there you go.
I don't know. They're cool people out there that I think deserve Bafta. Like, I don't think I should direct that. I don't know. I don't have a clear-cut answer. I guess, like, Gugush is amazing. She's this Iranian pop star, and I think someone just did a documentary about her, and I think she would make for a really compelling subject for a biopic. So my answer is Gugush.
Good answer. And what's the most unusual or unexpected place that you've found inspiration?
The most unusual or inspiring or beautiful place, you said?
Most unusual, unexpected place.
Unexpected.
That you've found inspiration.
I felt inspired. I played this game called Sardines last week, and it was like hide and seek, only it was in the dark with like a smoke machine on. And once you find the person hiding, you have to join them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really sensual experience in a lot of ways because you're just like blindly feeling around.
I'm just wondering where you're playing this game. I'm like, was this at work? I was like, where were you playing Sardines?
I was at a camp. I was at this camp called Zeno Mountain Farm for people with and without disabilities. And we were playing this game. And I was thinking, wow, this would be a really phenomenal scene. Yeah. Like it was such a tactile experience. There were so many different agendas in my head at that moment. But it was, yeah, the seeking and the looking and the listening, but not having my sight or everything being kind of smoky and blurry. It felt like it was a disco, but there was no disco. It was just this game.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on, but you'd see glimpses of bodies here and there. I was just thinking of a scene of someone, like had a crush on someone who was also playing. I was thinking, well, this would be really good. And I'm writing a rom-com, so I was like, this would be really sexy.
Oh, yeah, you should add that in there.
Have a body, like they would smell the person and feel them. And I don't know if you can express that on film, but I'm sure it's been done before, that like that kind of attraction in the dark.
Great answer as well. As just being a director and a writer, you must kind of find that kind of inspiration all the time, everywhere. Ideas for scenes that just come up in everyday life anyway.
Honestly, it's been a while, and it's, I think when life is going well and like things, that's when things flow and you're feeling confident and you're like good in yourself. And I think when you're trying too hard and you're miserably like, I must write the great script, a great script, the great script, who knows, but I must write. And that's when it's really hard. And fortunately lately I have been feeling cinematic and inspired.
So, yeah. That's good. You're on a good sort of flow then. Because I was wondering, like, yeah, if you get any kind of creator's block, how do you sort of break through that? Or if your sort of your inner critic is sort of getting at you, how do you, like, yeah, break out of that?
I'm still figuring that out, but I wonder if it's, like, doing things you love and stepping away. And it's hard to step away because you're so, you already feel bad for bad about yourself for not achieving more. You want, so the instinct is to lean further into the work. You're like, this isn't working, let me work harder. And I'm very bad at stepping away, but I actually think that it probably is smarter to just step away and engage in other things, other activities, and like actually live and then return when you're feeling a little stronger, a little more yourself.
Mm-hmm.
No, I gotta try this tactic and let you know if it worked out. But yes, that's what I think.
I'm the same. It works for me if I just sort of step away and go somewhere else and do something else and just experience life rather than getting sort of so caught up in like your, I don't know, like a bubble almost. Like you need to sort of break out of that. What kind of films are you loving at the moment? Are there a few films that you can recommend or filmmakers?
I haven't watched anything in a while. What have I been loving? I actually keep a list.
Do you have like a Letterboxd favorite top four?
I've never used Letterboxd, and I really need to.
You should get a Letterboxd account. I mean, I'm sure it won't be long before you're interviewed for your favorite, what's it called? Top four, favorite four? Like you pick your top five on your profile.
I mean, this is a little while ago, but I really love Drive My Car, and I want to rewatch it this week. I think it's such a beautiful film. I think all of his stuff is incredible. I don't care if it's 4 or 5 hours long. I will be compelled and at the edge of my seat for all of them, every last second of it. So that was one of the last things I really deeply loved. I'm trying to think, what were the Oscars? I really loved Anatomy of a Fall, just like everyone did.
Yes, I loved that as well.
Yeah, to keep a list now. I guess I gotta go on Letterboxd and actually mark what I'm watching because I'm not watching it.
It's very handy keeping track of what you're watching. I mean, you don't have to review everything, But it's a good way of being like, oh, what did I watch? And you can look back on the year. Yeah, it's easy to forget.
You lose track of what is influencing you.
Mm.
And at the moment, I'm losing track. I'll say that this year I was lucky enough to be at Cannes and watch The Substance. And it blew my fucking mind.
I really want to see that. I'm like waiting for it to appear in cinemas, but I don't know when it'll be out. But yeah, it was like the next sort of Titan kind of thing. Like, it's very gory, apparently, I've heard, so.
It's really gory, and I usually really hate gory, but it's gory with a purpose, which made it work for me. I thought the gore was this, like, amazing price of admission for the substance, the film. Like, there's so much depth there. It has so much to say, and it is just the most incredible, insane, absurd, hilarious depiction of female rage I have ever seen. And I really do I think this age, I'm like 39 right now, and I think this age is about rage, I think. Or maybe it's this moment in time, I don't know.
The rage age.
Self-included, just like full of fucking rage. And that movie just did it for me. I loved it so dearly. It's really phenomenal. So
well, it's firmly on my list, but yeah, you've convinced me even more that I need to see it. And the very last thing, what does the rest of the year look like for you? Are you going to be going on a book signing tour, or...?
I'll be back in the UK, so I'm shooting until October. I'll be back in the UK in the fall, and then I might do some UK, I hope, signings, talks around the book, inshallah, if all things go well. And then, yeah, just putting together the shoot financing for the Farsi language movie that we'll be making next, and writing... completing the script for a lesbian rom-com that I'm writing right now.
Well, exciting. It sounds like you've got loads of things in the pipeline, and yeah, really exciting, and I can't wait to read your book, and I hope it all goes really well. I've read a few good reviews already on The Guardian, and I read a snip of it on The Guardian because I was reading the article, and then it said at the end that it was taken from part of your book, so it sounds really good, so I'm excited to read the rest of it. Well, thank you very much for being on my podcast today, and it was lovely to meet you and chat to you, and thanks for all your insightful answers.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I'm so grateful to Desiree for taking the time out to chat with me, even while working on a major TV show. I really appreciated her honesty and authenticity and how she just shares without a filter, and it was really interesting to learn about how she works, creates and collaborates. Her new book, You're Embarrassing Yourself, Stories on Love, Lust and Movies, is out on August 15th, published by Penguin Random House. And if you want to be in with a chance to win a copy, I'll be doing a giveaway over at Real Girls Club on Instagram, which will be announced very soon. I'd love it if you could subscribe and review this podcast, or share it with anyone you think would love it too. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next month with a brand new episode, joined by Veronica Tofilska, director of Baby Reindeer.